Now, tonight's guest is the sixth man to walk on the moon. He has written a book called The Way of the Explorer, an Apollo astronaut's journey through the material and mystical worlds. In 1971, Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell became the sixth man to walk on the moon. Returning to Earth with crewmates Alan Shepard and Stu Roosa, he experienced a startling vision that has driven his life to this day. In his new book with Dwight Aaron Williams, The Way of the Explorer, Mitchell articulates this vision and summarizes the scientific studies, parapsychological experiments, and spiritual thinking that he has done or that he's been doing for the last quarter century. Kirkus Reviews has praised The Way of the Explorer as an exciting and stimulating attempt to reinvent the wheel. Mitchell's epiphany in space was that his mission as an astronaut, moreover the existence of the universe itself, was not an accident. He knew there was an intelligent process at work and that he and other humans could, indeed must, connect to it. A year and a half after his return, he left NASA to devote his life to exploring his theories. He founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences in January 1973, an organization which now has 50,000 members. Its mission is to encourage and sponsor scientific research around the world in the nature of consciousness. Much of this leading-edge research is described in The Way of the Explorer. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the program tonight Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's nice to be with you.
Thank you for being on the program. I guess the thing I want to focus on, first of all, is the book. Get to the bottom line for us about what the book is about.
Well, the studies that I've been doing for quite a number of years, I think, lead us to the conclusion, as many others have come to the conclusion, that the universe really isn't structured the way we thought. How do we put together what our science has been teaching us for 400 years on one side and our mystical experience or inner experience on the other hand? And the two of them don't come together very well, and this is an attempt to bring them together and to show that they do indeed fit together. They're not mutually exclusive, as we have come to believe, that there is a way of looking at this that makes the world look about like it we experience it.
Right. And I think you're hitting the nail on the head. I think the core of the whole thing is the disparate relationship between the religions and science.
Right.
Okay. We're going to get back to that after we come back from our break, and we'll get into the book a little bit more and some of your observations and experiences, and we'll cover that in much more detail. Again, my guest is Dr. Edgar Mitchell. He is the author of the new book, The Way of the Explorer. It is now out on the market in major bookstores. I highly recommend getting a copy and reading it. I've been scanning it myself and find it very interesting. We're going to talk about that more in depth tonight. I guess for our audience, tell me what happened in your life that has brought you to this point. Because I think a lot of people are curious to know how someone with a very fine scientific mind arrives at where you are today.
Well, it began very early in life when I experienced rather serious dichotomies between the science I was learning and my religious upbringing as a child in a very fundamentalist tradition. And I had these questions that have been with me all my life. And it was only in this, and I put them kind of on the back burner for many years. But during the space flight, as I looked at the cosmos from that perspective, and being one of the first of we humans to get out there, these questions all came back, and it was rather clear that our traditional answers, both from science and from our cultural cosmologies or religious cosmologies, didn't hold up very well. So we needed to find new ones, and that's what I've been doing.
Okay. All right, let's take a call. We've got a caller on our line one. We've got line one. We've got Brian calling in on our affiliate, KHOW 2, KHOW 2 in Denver. Good evening, Brian.
Good evening. How you doing, Mark?
Good.
Dr. Mitchell, I've got two questions to ask you. First of all, kind of at odd what you've done. The first question I have is, back in September of 94, while attending a Planetary Society meeting in Denver, where Alan B. Shepard was the guest speaker, there was a small group afterwards that asked him a question concerning some of Richard Hoagland's NASA photos.
Mm-hmm.
His comment was, quote, that I cannot confirm or deny what you are asking, but let it be known that my presence here tonight be food for thought. He also had stated that it wasn't public disinterest that stopped the lunar missions, that basically was the bureaucratic cost of continuing missions and the lack of improper total mission goal planning. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that may be somewhat misinterpretation of what Alan said. I was with him last night. We've talked these things over in light of all this recent interest. I was with he and a whole group of guys. I would say you raised a number of questions here that the slant you're putting on them is not the one I would put on them at all. I don't know quite which one to start with, but yes, the congressional funding process did terminate the lunar flights, I think, a little bit early, but in response to public will. The public really wasn't ready to go forward with it any further at that point.
Why do you think that was, Dr. Mitchell?
We just happened to be a very fickle public. What have you done for me today? And we made the lunar flights look a little bit too easy. It was not obvious that enough new data was coming out to the scientists. It was quite obvious we still had a lot to do. But to the general public, they really couldn't see that we were getting our money's worth, because they don't understand that depth of science. But I believe we could have kept going for some time and gained a lot of new information. Now, there's other questions here that if you trigger me on one of them, I'll see if I can pick that one up, too.
Are you still there, Brian?
Yes, sir. One last question, and then I'll go. Could you answer why is it that if not all, most of the Apollo mission astronauts are members of the Masonic Order? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I don't know that they are. I know quite a few of the fellows are. They're also Boy Scouts. A number of the traditional organizations that we've had in this country, but I don't know if there's any more significance to it than that. Oh, the other thought I wanted to just occurred to me was with regard to the photographs and the claims of Hoagland and other photo interpreters. And let's not be ambiguous about that. I know that Alan isn't. I'm not. Al Bean is not. And Buzz Aldrin is not. All of these claims that there are objects in our photographs that are not being reported is just simply not true. We've gone through this a number of times. And that isn't to say there is no possibility that artifacts of some sort might be on the moon. I can't say that. That's impossible.
Okay. Now, Dr. Mitchell, let me jump in here at this point and ask you this question, because I tend to agree with you on some aspects of what you're saying, because of the fact that I don't feel that there's enough solid evidence to indicate that there is any of that stuff that Mr. Hoagland refers to. However, do you feel that, are you saying then that it's essentially that there's a possibility that there could be something up there that we haven't discovered yet? Or?
But I can clear this up from my point of view very quickly.
Okay.
I think modern thinkers in this area are coming to the conclusion that likely life is ubiquitous throughout the universe. It's not the single accident here on Earth that previous thinking, even 30, 40 years ago, led us to believe. That more than likely the conditions that spawned life here have spawned life elsewhere. Now, the question of have we found each other is quite a different question. And it would not take a civilization too much older than we, a few hundred million years, a billion years, which is not unthinkable, to perhaps have discovered us. But we still, in spite of all the controversy about UFOs, we do not have in the public domain smoking gun type evidence. Now, I personally have no firsthand experience.
Well, maybe not in the public domain. Do you think that there's something behind, say, the veil of the black budget kind of that arena?
Well, that's my next comment.
Okay.
I have no firsthand experience there either. But I have recently been, and I've been very skeptical of the whole area,
okay,
but I have been recently in contact with people within government who claim firsthand experience, significant firsthand experience, and who are working very hard to get the veil of secrecy lifted and to get such people that have classified stories released from their classified restrictions so that they can tell their stories. And I support this effort enormously.
You do think that there could be something behind the veil of secrecy?
Oh, I think so. Okay. I think that the evidence is rather strong that there is a lot of classified material that should be released to the public, and this very telling. Whether it truly amounts to smoking gun evidence, that remains to be seen. I kind of think it probably does, but that's just conjecture.
Okay. All right. Now, let's take another call. We've got a couple minutes before our next break. Let's take David calling in from our affiliate KIDO in Nampa, Idaho, on line two. David, good evening. What's your question for our guest?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now I can hear you.
What's your question, David?
I've got my radio down, so it's kind of hard.
Okay.
I seen a UFO when I was a kid. I also seen the inside of it. I was wondering if I could give a real quick, brief description to see if perhaps he's heard of any like it.
Well, I've heard of most of them, but I've read the same literature you probably have, so what I would say might not doesn't really add anything to it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, anyway, this one was about 30 feet across, fresh aluminum on the outside. There was a circular opening in the top of the craft. Through that was like a half-spiral staircase, which was more of a half-twist in the spiral because it didn't have the pole that goes up the center. It had kind of a brownish-red tint to the railings, kind of like anodized aluminum. It also had black steps with a brownish-red trim. The floor was black. The console is a regular aluminum color.
Okay. Let me interrupt you. I simply can't confirm or deny anything you're saying because I have no experience to do that.
And it sounds to me, David, like it's a fairly typical description of what's been reported already.
Oh, I can't hear you real well. Anyway, has there been anything done, like in gravitational research with metals and stuff, to actually, has anybody considered using the metal as a... as part of the propulsion system, being able to actually...
Oh, there's a lot of work in what's called zero-point energy fields now and new field force field approaches that are probably going to yield some very useful information. I'm familiar with a number of scientists working in these areas, and it looks very promising over the next few years. Absolutely. A relook at the whole gravitational phenomenon, the propulsion phenomenon, is moving quite nicely.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
And, of course, that was President Kennedy who, in the early 60s, put the major thrust into the exploration of the moon. Welcoming back my guest, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, talking about his book, The Way of the Explorer. And, Dr. Mitchell, one of the things I've noticed in your book is the apparent conflict, and I think you've already touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to touch on it a little bit more. How do you reconcile such an important aspect of our human evolvement? How do you reconcile the idea that there is so much politics involved and it makes it so difficult to do real science?
Well, that is just one of the problems of being human at this point in time, point in history. Our science is really only 400 years old, dating back to Sir Isaac Newton and that period of the Industrial Revolution. And our thinking about these issues of what is our nature, what is our consciousness, where did we come from, how did we get here, and why, and so forth, go back as long as humans have been self-reflective, which is about 3,000 years. And so we have conflicts that have been unresolved. It's been my opinion that the way we resolve these conflicts is understand what it is that makes us conscious. Of course, that's what my book is all about.
And of course,
we haven't been able to resolve that till this point.
And of course, some of that exploration borders on what most people would consider fringe.
Yes, it used to be. When we started doing in the Institute of Noetic Sciences in the early 70s, a lot of it was considered fringe, very deep fringe. At this point, so much of it is really mainstream. The notion that attitude affects your well-being, the idea that maybe we're not the center of the universe biologically. The idea that, well, acupuncture is probably a viable diagnostic tool and a alternative health tool. Biofeedback is a mechanism for helping us control ourselves. Those are all mainstream ideas now.
What's your? I'm just curious. What is your academic background?
Well, I have a PhD from MIT.
In what discipline?
In aeronautics and astronautics. We created a course back in the late 50s and early 60s to go into space with.
Do you find your colleagues or associates or your peers giving you any difficulty about your ideas?
Oh, no.
Okay.
They used to. They used to say, gee, where's Ed going? But by and large, time has changed all of that. We've got many people coming in and asking questions. Even back in the early 70s, they'd come in furtively and close the door and ask what's going on. But now it's pretty open. A lot of people are, the times have changed.
I think that's good news. Let's take another call. We've got John calling in on our affiliate KHOW2, or KHOW2 in Denver. Good evening, John. What's your question for our guest, Dr. Edgar Mitchell?
Yes, I was wondering if he had heard anything, if he thinks there's anything to this so-called photon belt that our galaxy is supposed to be moving toward and that it's going to have profound effects on human consciousness, for one thing.
Well, I can't speak to the scientific validity of moving toward a photon belt. I don't think it probably has too much to do with our consciousness, whatever it is.
But it does exist, and we are moving toward it.
Well, I'm not an astronomer, so I can't speak to that. But I will go with what the consensus of the astronomers are, because they have their system of peer review and studies that eventually, even though we go by fits and starts, eventually gets down to the nitty-gritty of the truth.
Dr. Mitchell, what are the pitfalls involved in science and the exploration of, say, parapsychological phenomena?
Okay, let me address the first subject here of parapsychology. I no longer even use the word para.
What do you call it?
It's just normal.
Okay.
We start with the assumption that what we're dealing with is normal phenomena that is not yet explained. And there's no paranormal parascience. There is really no supernatural. At least the modeling that I use in my book says this is all explainable if we eventually understand the unknown. And that's the position I take. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, I applaud you for your fortitude in trying to explore this. But, you know, the one problem that we keep coming back to here is, and I have not seen any change in it. Obviously, you're saying that there is, but that it seems like there's still this huge stigma between the scientific thinking and, you know, unexplained phenomena.
That's true. Well, there's always, let's be careful about what is we call unexplained. We still have many, many enigmas that aren't resolved.
Okay.
But what I'm talking about here are those relating to consciousness and mind. And the problem is we're still stuck in many ways back in Newtonian reality, which said mind is epiphenomenal. It's a secondary product of physical nature. And in my book, I go at it a somewhat different way, although I suggest there's really a single reality. There is not, as Descartes said, mind over here and matter over here. Mind and matter are two faces of the same reality. But if you look at them the way I do, most of these paradoxes that cause us to call things paranormal and strange simply disappear. And it falls out into a pretty nice system of thought. Now, and it's also testable. We'll either find out, is it right or is it wrong?
Do you think most people are willing to accept the outcome? I mean, granted, you're right. You know, the true test is the observation and the proving.
Let me give you some statistics real quickly. Since we started the Institute 20-some years ago, the group of people we now call the postmoderns or cultural creatives have increased, and that's the constituency, I would say, is interested and involved in the sort of things we're talking about, seeking new answers. That constituency has moved from less than 2% of the population to over 24%. In other words, representing about 44 million adult Americans. And the three groups that are called traditionalist, which is just what it sounds, the modernist, which really means classical materialist thinking, very much involved with corporate economics, the sort of yuppie group that has dominated thinking here for the last 25 or 30 years. All those groups are now equal size, roughly 23 to 24%. And the cultural creatives are increasing very rapidly. The other two are decreasing significantly. So the people thinking and looking at the solutions we're talking about are increasing quite nicely.
We're going to take a call right away out of the break here. We've got Tim on line one. He's listening in on the Internet, on the web, from Chicago. Good evening, Tim. What's your answer, or what's your question for our guest, Dr. Mitchell?
Hi, Michael. Dr. Mitchell, it's an honor to speak to you. My question concerns some of the claims made by Carl Sagan.
What?
And he's obviously very dismissive of alien contact, and I wonder, how do you respond to that? And if you think you have proof, you know, have you brought it forward to the scientific community?
Well, I don't think we, this is what I stated just a few minutes ago, I don't think we have smoking gun proof of any sort. But what has changed? The great astronomer Fred Hoyle back in the 1950s said 500 years ago, Copernicus disabused us of the notion that we're the geometric center of the universe, but we still think we're the biological center. And even when I went to the moon 25 years ago, we still thought we're the biological center. I think those notions are falling by the wayside. Do we have proof? No. However, what is changing very rapidly is the cosmological understanding of how we came to be. And what is emerging as a model is that we live in a self-organizing, intelligent, trial-and-error universe that's evolving, that started with the Big Bang, and continues to evolve both in its structure and in our knowing about it. And that's the subject of my book, is breaking this down into what exists and how do we know, as being two facets of our universe. But it's quite a different matter to say we're in a self-organizing, learning, evolving universe than what we used to think even 75 years ago. The whole model is changing markedly. Now, Carl Sagan is correct in that we don't have smoking gun evidence of other life in the universe, but the model, the materialist model based firmly upon early quantum mechanics and Newtonian science are simply proving to be wrong. They're flawed.
Dr. Mitchell, do you think that the this, I know that there's a lot of conspiracy theory stuff that's out there, and I mean a lot of it is probably basically unfounded, and it's just
that's true.
Stimulates the imagination of certain minds. But the question is this: what do you say to things like the Brookings Institute, you know, study that they did in the early '60s? Did NASA set policy? And if they did, is there a possibility that there is some sub-agency out there that is actually calling all the shots that may or may not know something?
Well, that's probably too much of a conspiracy theory. I think what has really happened is that since the early days of the so-called Roswell incident, when we were just coming out of World War II, when the military and secrecy and the Soviet threat, we were just getting into the Cold War, was very real, and national security problems were very real, and high classifications surrounded all of this activity. Since that time, a lot has happened. It's moved into the black budgets. It has been spun off with some contractors looking at it, some military people looking at it. It's almost a quasi-private activity now, and the danger in that is the fact that black budgets are not really being monitored carefully by our Congress. They can't, just by their nature. So we have something here that's quasi-private, quasi-military, quasi-intelligence that's not really being controlled in the best way.
Personally, I think it's a monster.
It is a monster. You said it nicely. It is a monster. And we need to open this up and get it out here in the open.
Yeah,
whatever it is, get it open.
I fully agree with you, because one of the things I did notice in your book is that, you know, there was that struggle between the civilian side of things
yep.
and the military side. And, of course, now we know that Dick Truly was more into the peaceful exploration of space, whereas Golden is more militaristic.
Well, he came out of the military-industrial complex.
Right.
And I personally want to follow Eisenhower's dictum of when NASA was established. NASA was established for peaceful exploration of space. And we just have this natural tension between the military side who wants to manage space and those of us who really prefer that it be under peaceful civilian control.
Right. Now, I noticed you grew up in, you were a boy, when you were a boy, you were in Roswell,
yep.
New Mexico. How do you view the so-called Roswell incident?
Well, I know Jesse Marcel Jr. personally. I know many of these people and have talked with many of the people who were involved with that. Now, I was just a lad at that time, still an adolescent, and kind of didn't know what to think about it and kind of dismissed it like everybody else that wasn't knowledgeable. I now believe that there was a massive cover-up. I now believe that these folks were telling the truth as they saw it and that they were put under an enormous amount of pressure to keep quiet.
So do you think that something extraterrestrial really crashed?
Well, there's something that needs to be opened up. And let's say on one side it could very well be extraterrestrial, but whatever it is, the truth is not out in the public domain.
Okay. Let's take another call. We've got Wally calling in from our affiliate KCNR in Ogden, Utah. Good evening, Wally. What's your question for our guest? Hello? Wally?
I don't think we have him yet.
Yeah. Is Wally there? Okay, Wally, you're going once? I guess he's gone. When you were in NASA, how much did you talk about the Roswell case? Did you ever hear anything about it?
We didn't talk about it at all. NASA's official position in those days, this stuff doesn't exist. Don't worry about it. We weren't briefed on it. We were going to the moon to, like the bear going over the mountain, to see what he could see for discovery, for science, for the sheer exploration of it, and because our president gave us that as a mission. But any thought of were there extraterrestrials simply wasn't on the table.
And my guest is Dr. Edgar Mitchell, and we're going to take a call real quick. We've got Angie calling in on our affiliate KCNR in Salt Lake. Good evening, Angie. What's your question?
Hi. I was just wondering if Edgar saw any unusual formations on the moon. I spoke with Fred Hayes. He came to Weber State about a couple months ago, and I had asked him, and he said the closest he came to the moon on Apollo 13 was about, I think, 80 miles away, and he said he didn't
see anything.
So I was just wondering if he did.
Okay.
Well, as far as strange and interesting things, yeah, we saw a lot of strange and interesting things, but not strange in the sense of unexplainable or abnormal or something like that. No.
I guess it's quite an interesting experience to stand on the moon, isn't it?
Yeah. As an explorer, as a budding lunar geologist, it was exciting to be there and to do the science and just to poke around and find out what's there. But as far as what we're really talking about here, no, there was nothing really strange.
Okay. Now, real quick, Dr. Mitchell, we've got to wrap this up, but I'm just curious, where is all of this headed?
Oh, to greater understanding, to be able to answer the questions of who are we, how did we get here, where are we going, and why, and what is our responsibility in all of this? We're not just we're not just objects in a totally inanimate, unknowing universe. We have a responsibility here, it appears. We seem to represent the forefront of intelligent organization, at least in our sector of the universe. And that's kind of a heavy thought.
It is a very heavy thought. Now, I know you want to make an announcement about people, how they can get your book, an autographed copy of your book. How do they do that?
Well, certainly the book itself is in, it should be in all the bookstores now, but that didn't get people an autographed copy that would like one. If they'd like to write to me at Post Office Box 6728 in Lake Worth, Florida, 33461, that's Post Office Box 6728, Lake Worth, Florida, 33461, and send $35 in check or money order, I'll be glad to send them out an autographed copy and dedicate it to them.
Very good. And one last question I have for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you happy with the space program today, or is there something, if you were the administrator,
it needs regrouping, it needs reorganizing. we really need to use the space program at this moment to help focus on Earth problems. We've got some severe problems here. And then eventually we will go back to the moon. We'll go on to Mars. We will go on to the rest of the solar system. It's our destiny to do so. But right now I think we need to get our act together on Earth.
Okay. Well, Dr. Mitchell, it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you,
Michael. I want to thank you very much for taking the time this evening to enlighten us and talk about your book. Again, my guest has been Dr. Edgar Mitchell. He is the author of the book, The Way of the Explorer, An Apollo Astronaut's Journey Through the Material and Mystical World. And as Dr. Mitchell mentioned, it is on the major book shelves now, and you can get a copy of it out there. It's published by Putnam and Company.